Do it.
Okay. Get in the tub.
Don't you get in the tub!
Right next to the tub.
In the tub.
In the tub, bitch.
In the tub, bitch.
I just like getting out of the tub.
Yeah.
In the tub, bitch.
Tubcast.
Welcome to the Tubcast, everyone. We're back at it. Haven't done a Tubcast in a year, 2 years. It may have been 2 years since we've done the last podcast, but we are back at the Tubcast. We have a special guest. Welcome, Ken, to the podcast.
Thank you.
Want to do a little intro, who you are, or your tub memory? I don't know. Oh. What was your first tub experience?
My first tub experience? Oh, that's a good one. What was it? I know I can probably remember. I know we saw Midnight Cowboy, but I know I've been to the tub before that. Face Off, we watched that, but I was at the tub before that too.
Those are some good nights. And or was Synapse the first time?
I don't think Synapse was the first time, but we did watch Synapse there and it was amazing.
Oh, was it Galaxy Quest? No.
No.
Miss.
Oh, man. This is crazy because I'm pretty good at remembering stuff like this. It'll come back to me.
When it comes back to you, you just
it'll say, come back
say,
to me.
I know the first tub,
and I'll remember.
Tub experience.
Yeah.
I mean, is there anything to plug? Like, do you want to plug your Instagram? Do you have a podcast?
Well, I'm a Los Angeles-based filmmaker. I've directed music videos, commercials, television, independent feature. I directed a lot of music videos for, a group called Above and Beyond a few years ago. That was really cool for their We're All We Need album. They were nominated for a Grammy for that album. I've directed for Warner Records, Atlantic Records. I've directed different commercial work. And I was a director on a Netflix series called Guardians of Justice that was created by visionary filmmaker Adi Shankar.
Who hasn't been to the tub yet?
No, he hasn't been to the tub.
No, I don't mean to call him out. I don't know.
Well, one of these days we're going to get him.
That's being edited now. That's what I mean.
The tub is amazing. So there's lots of great memories of the tub. And it's a place where memories are made. Memories are shown and made at the tub.
Exactly.
It's kind of an inception situation. You know, you're experiencing and creating all at the same time,
we haven't even played Inception at the tub. I think that's maybe.
Oh, I think yeah. What a great one that would be.
Blind spot for the tub. But this episode of the Tubcast, we are going to be talking about summer movies, or more specifically, what makes a good summer movie. And hopefully, Inception probably is a pretty good summer.
Oh, that's a great one.
And hopefully, we can get an idea for next month's tub schedule or next month's tub screenings in July. So, I mean, right now it's June 25th? 5th?
Or 1st?
21st.
Hold on.
I have no idea.
It's June 20th.
June 20th. So hopefully I'll get this thing pumped out soon and we can start thinking about next month. So let's just start there. What makes a good summer movie to Ken?
Well, I'm going to say, first and foremost, a film released during the summer. And what
that's
constitutes...
An important one.
What constitutes the summer movie season? I would say the beginning of May, with maybe 2 weeks of April as an exception, as like a buffering space, to the end of August. August 31st would probably be the end of the summer. So any film that's basically released within those three/3.5 months qualifies as a summer film. And generally speaking, although this is definitely not the case and we can discuss this, but summer films, you know, I think the generally looked at as kind of the big tentpole style films.
The blockbusters.
The blockbusters, yeah. But I don't think that it has to be, you know, exactly that either. I think there's a lot of sleeper hits, and through the years there have been everything from rom-coms to dramas that have been big summer movies, right, along with superhero films and action movies and stuff.
And I would even say there's some movies that were released in the summer that ended up being good holiday movies. Example, Die Hard, right? Die Hard came out, I think, June, early June.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, boom, we got the Christmas movie.
Yes, absolutely.
It was released, you know, in December, you know, the Oscar window, we'll call it, the November, December, that have now become really good summer movies.
Yeah.
But definitely that's a huge, huge one to note, is a lot of summer movies are just released in the summer, and it's because they can make a lot of money in the summer.
Yeah.
Or maybe historically it could. I don't know if that's still the case now.
I think that there's I think that's shifted a little bit, because now I think you see a lot of bigger movies moving to windows February.
Right.
Where they'll try, you know, Valentine's Day, and Deadpool was released around that time. So you have situations where they
kind of... Black Panther too, right? Was that February?
Black Panther was released in February. And so, you know, there's definitely times, you know, where you can kind of, you know, not every single huge movie obviously is released strictly during the summer. So it kind of bounces around a little bit. But I think historically speaking, at least when I would say we were growing up, that's basically been the time where you kind of get those really big, big movies.
Right.
Christmas too, but...
Do you think there's a difference between a June summer movie versus a July summer movie, or that early window, the April summer?
I think that I would say back in the day, you know, July was probably the pinnacle moment where you would really release the biggest films, and something like an Independence Day or whatever, I think probably came out around July 4th or something.
It's gotta be, right?
And obviously there's a element of it being a holiday, and, you know, people are, you know, probably off work and doing things with their family. So you kind of try to really gear, you know, it into July when you think that people will be available to go watch the movies.
Right. And I mean, I don't know when school gets out these days, but I think you could make the argument that the reason why summer movies are the blockbuster movies is because, you know, kids or people are free in the beginning of summer.
Yes. You know? Now we are following right now a historic weekend after only a few weeks ago, a few films that unfortunately didn't do well that were great movies. And people were kind of declaring that this was the end of theater going, et cetera, et cetera. And then the last 2 weeks, both films have overperformed. Bad Boys, Ride or Die, and Inside Out, which I think actually broke some records this weekend.
Did it really?
Yeah. So so that's a perfect example. Inside Out 2 is a perfect example because it's a family film and released in the summer. And it's the perfect, in some ways, opportunity.
Do you think that... at least this year's case stems from maybe there not being that many movies released?
I think
this last, you know, 2 weeks, right?
I would say so. I mean, I felt that back in the day, when I say back in the day, I kind of probably am thinking of my formative years, a teenage kind of early 20s, that kind of really, we'll say the high watermark of...
Which movies would be releasing around this time?
Well, you would have maybe two or three films that size releasing simultaneously on one weekend in the summer. And there would be multiple films competing at the same time. So something that happened last year, which was the Oppenheimer Barbie mm-hmm. situation, or Barbenheimer, which was this kind of cultural phenomenon. That was something that happened, I think, a little more regularly before, because they were releasing a lot more films. And generally at the time, probably movies cost less, and so you could make more films rather than banking every single film has to be $100 million. I mean,
do you think it's just, you know, blind chance that something like Barbenheimer came about, or do you think it has anything to do with the quality of the movie or the release window? I shouldn't ask that because there's no answer to it, but...
I think that that's a great question, though, because... And I think people will probably, for a long time, discuss, you know, the phenomenon of Barbenheimer and why that,
right,
hit so well, because both of those films I mean, Oppenheimer got very close to $1 billion, so you could say it's a $1 billion movie. And obviously Barbie did as well. And so Barbie crossed $1 billion. So to kind of like go, what was it? I think like one of the things that's different than years before, and something the world is still kind of acclimating to, is the role of social media in things. And so with Barbenheimer, you know, you had that kind of catching on social media. So then it's gonna travel in a way that maybe didn't exist before. But the counter programming was really smart in that,
right?
You know, both films, you know, just the difference in the visual, was like the contrast was so great between the two of them. But they were both being made by prestigious filmmakers and big studios. So, it just kind of was like the whole kind of interesting mix there that really allowed, you know, got them to kind of like benefit each other, you know?
So why didn't we get something like that with Furiosa?
That's a great question. And I very much enjoyed Furiosa, and I love all the Mad Max films.
I think people were really banking on it making money, not because Fury Road made a lot of money, but because Fury Road has this reputation, this, you know, this following that just, you know, completely blew up since it came out in what, 2015, I think?
2016? Yeah. 2015. Yeah. And I think,
it makes sense that they expected it to be a big release, but at the same time, it's like that one didn't make release on, you know, release. So,
And Fury Road, it's funny because nobody mentioned that, like, or people weren't talking about the fact that Fury Road was also nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director, and it won 6 Oscars. So all of those things, I think, kind of like were momentum kind of moving into doing something like Furiosa. And of course, like Mad Max Fury Road, a film that definitely would be a great, you know, movie to, I mean, you could do a whole podcast just analyzing that and obviously what kind of a visionary film it was. You know, I think that, but if I was just to be honest, I think that maybe a little too much time has passed.
Right.
I think that might, that's not always the case. Cause when I was thinking about summer films and I was thinking about like Bad Boys, the original Bad Boys from 1995, and then Bad Boys 2, which was 2003.
Was that big of a gap
between the two? There's 8 years between those two films, and they both managed to do really well. Now, granted, it's like a different situation. It'd be like Bad Boys 1 is the movie we saw, and then Bad Boys 2 is like a prequel about Mike Lowry and how he becomes like this cool cop or something. Right. So you can't really compare the two. If they'd done maybe a direct sequel off of Mad Max Fury Road, which I'm not saying they should have done or anything, but I mean, that would probably be a more comparable situation.
I mean, was the release window wrong, maybe? Because I wish we had a fact checker with us. I'm pretty sure Fury Road came out in, like, March. We can always check.
I think it did. I'm going to look right now.
Not to say that Fury Road made a lot of money, but it kind of was. This is Fury Road, which you would think now is a perfect summer movie, wasn't released as a summer movie.
Right.
So maybe it was them kind of banking on it being a big summer movie, so it had this expectation, but
yeah. I don't know. It definitely just, I mean, I think it kind of like feels like it should be.
It definitely feels like it should be. And the main reason being, summer movies are usually, or ideally, they are action movies, right?
Yeah.
Or the blockbuster, the ones that, you know,
you're going to get some big set pieces going on, you know, something really just,
which Fury Road is just a 2-hour set piece.
Non-stop. Right? Non-stop. It's so good. It's so great.
So before I do, I want to talk about action movies, and I want to talk about specific movies so that we can plan the month. But I do want to say that my go-to, and you can say yours too, my go-to summer movie, summer whatever, is Jaws. Oh, and yeah. I don't know if you can call Jaws an action movie. It's like, is it a horror movie? I guess I never really thought about it.
Well, I think that Jaws is regarded as the beginning of the summer movie blockbuster right. season. Because if I'm not mistaken, it was the first film to gross over $100 million domestically at the right. box office. And so it was a huge film. And it definitely like leans into, I mean, you could say a horror film and you could say a monster movie. Mm-hmm. But that's the thing. And I would say to some degree, when I'm thinking about like, say, action films in the summer, the more grounded in some ways they are, the more that they kind of qualify. And I would say that Jaws is overall a very grounded action film.
Right.
It's believable in the sense that, I mean, is there a homicidal shark out there that's, you know, trying to eat boats and stuff? I don't know. Maybe. But either way, it like the events that play out, I think that's one of the elements of power to that film is the fact that it is so relatable to the fact that it, you know, to the point that it makes people afraid to go in the water and afraid of sharks because they think they're going to have a shark or a Jaws experience.
Which water obviously makes a very good a very good summer movie. You know, we're all thinking about going to the beach or that, you know, and I think it really hits on that perfectly.
Yeah.
But then again, I think of Jaws as the best summer movie or one of the best summer movies. But if you ask me what genre a summer movie would be, I wouldn't say it's, you know, the monster movie, the horror movie. I would say it's the action movie.
Yes. I would say that's the predominant, that would be like the kind of predominant thought, you know. But then you have like, you know, you have movies that have been huge, like Oppenheimer, The Sixth Sense right. was released, I think, in August. And My Best Friend's Wedding came out in June. And those are, you know, those are like counter-programming summer films. But I would say, like, generally, the action movie is certainly, like,
yeah, that's
what you kind of lean to.
That's the main one. So what would be your ideal action movie? Or, really, ideal summer movie, if we want to stay on topic?
That is, like...
You don't have to have one.
I would say, okay, for me, I will list a few.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
Let's stop at each one and we can talk about
okay.
it.
This one is certainly grounded but also with sci-fi elements would be Terminator 2. Mm-hmm. From 1991. Obviously just a massive film. I think the first film that was budgeted over $100 million as well. And but incredible action. When I was growing up, I was a teenager when Speed was released in theaters, which was
Speed would be great at the time.
Oh, Speed was like such a, I still remember watching it. Like I remember where I was, everything, watching that in the theater. And it was just like such a impactful experience. And it was exhilarating. Let's see.
T2, we played at the tub. I will say it's one of my biggest regrets. Not that no problem with the movie. The movie's a masterpiece. I love T2. But we played Terminator 2 from the 4K Blu-ray, the infamous 4K Blu-ray, which looks terrible.
Yeah.
I think James Cameron, I think they made it off of like the 3D version of the film or something weird like that. There's something weird plasticky about it, but I'm like, I want to give the Tubbies another chance to see T2
yeah.
in a theater because that movie is
incredible and it holds up. And
oh, yeah.
I mean, outside of, you know, that 4K transfer, like it is the cinematography, everything about it, like it looks so, so good and it doesn't feel or look dated. The visual effects, I mean, it's over 30 years old and the visual effects are pretty incredible.
There are a few movies that, as much as I would love to screen him at the tub, I think of, you know, like The Arrow or The Egyptian or The New Beverly. I'm like, if they were playing there, I would recommend seeing it there. And yeah. that's definitely one. T2 is one. I'm like, see like a grimy film print of T2.
Oh, and yeah.
You'll just have a blast.
Yeah, absolutely.
We did it as a double feature with Terminator 1, which I don't know if I can recommend. It's more of a gimmick, just the whole Arnold role swapping between protagonists or antagonists and protagonists.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like it's so much of the same. There's no contrast like the Barbenheimer that, anyway, this is a side tangent. I wouldn't do it as a double feature, but I do like the first movie and the second movie a lot.
Yes, they're very different in the sense that James Cameron switched genres to some extent mm-hmm. when he did, which is also what he did when he came back to do the sequel to Alien, when he did Aliens,
exactly.
kind of mm-hmm. changed genres a little bit, which is a smart move so that he's not repeating something. It's evolving whatever he's doing to the next level. So right. whereas the first Terminator is certainly a sci-fi horror film with action elements, the Terminator 2 is very much a sci-fi action film
right.
with a, you know, I wouldn't even say there's too many horror elements other than when Miles Dyson really? Sees him take the hand off and he's like taking it and he's revealing like that sequence is
the horror of seeing that.
It's so good because the way the performance is in that sequence, like Miles Dyson and then the actress playing his wife, like the look of horror on their face of somebody like tearing their skin off in front of them. It's so like realistic, like. And they like it was directed in a way to be like, if you actually saw this, how would your reaction be? It would just be like you'd be beside yourself. So
well, we get that reaction when we see him in the mirror with the.
Oh yeah.
So we do get a piece of what they were feeling.
Oh yeah. That's great. I would say going on the James Cameron kick for a second. Mm-hmm. I would also say True Lies is
okay,
another.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic summer action film. I remember when I saw that the first time as well, and it was just incredible. I would even say, here I'm going to say this, make
say
this
it.
Declaration on
say
the
it.
Tubcast. I would say James Cameron's the greatest action film director living today. You know, and that's not to take away from, obviously, so many incredible action film directors. But I think his the way everything is just the clarity of the action sequences, the kind of like I think there's a lot of character focus. There's like a certain kind of like almost hypnotic, captivating quality mm-hmm. to the way he shoots them. Like it's very, very thought out and amazing. And like and you know, because when they made True Lies, you know, they actually were doing having the Harrier jets hanging and doing all of that stuff that's like just kind of mind-boggling, especially for the age. And then here I'm going now. This is a James Cameron podcast.
It's good,
but you know, also including something like you know, Titanic and obviously mm-hmm. the Avatar films.
Well, I think part of it is his desire, his like necessity for like innovation in
yes.
his filmmaking. So mm-hmm. there's something about an action movie where you're seeing something that you've never seen before. Or you're seeing something with such high stakes or whatever that just makes you feel amazed.
Yeah, absolutely.
He just does perfectly. Because he feels like he has to do that every single movie.
Yes. And I would say that, like, even with, like you're saying, this kind of, you know, the innovation in his filmmaking in terms of technology, like, he never loses sight of the story and kind of just kind of maintaining, like, a clarity. And I would say, and I mean this, like, absolutely 100% in a complimentary sense, like, a simplicity to, like, how the narrative goes. Like he balances, you know, this kind of, you know, if he's showing you something like an Avatar, like this very, like this incredible technology, he makes sure the story is very clear and that the kind of motivations of the characters are very relatable. And so it, like everything just flows together really,
which
really well.
Some people have a problem with, in particular with Avatar, where people think, you know, the story is not as, you know, innovative as his has how he's, you know, shooting the action. But I agree with you that I think that's why it works so well as a movie and as an action movie, is because you have like this foundation of just a solid story that moves really well, really paced well. Like, I don't know. I think it's a good thing.
It's a very smart move, because if you tried to do, you know, people had never seen, like when Avatar came out, nobody had ever seen something like that. Like it was just totally new technology and just incredible, and how realistic it looked. Again, I saw that in IMAX. I saw it at the IMAX in Ontario, At the Regal, they have a great IMAX there. And I remember watching that film and nobody, the entire theater was packed and nobody got up for 3 hours, not to use the restroom, nothing. Like everybody sat completely captivated. And I think that that is one of the strengths is like you keep, you know, if you're going to go really like bring in this new visual that like people have never seen before, if you add like an overly complicated narrative on top of that, it's too much in a sense. So relying on get kind of, we'll say, more familiar archetypes for characters and a story that people kind of like understand, and then blowing them away with like this amazing visual technology. Oh, it's so smart. It's so smart.
Oh yeah. What's another film, not necessarily to veer away from the James Cameron.
Oh yeah. Talk, yeah. No,
but what's a similar, what's another movie they have a similar passion for?
I would say the most summer like action film, not the most ever, but definitely like you could say the most ever, but obviously there's plenty of room to debate it, is Bad Boys 2. Bad Boys 2 is...
I knew it was coming.
Oh, it's coming. I mean, you can't leave Michael Bay out of this conversation. And the thing I'll say, you know, obviously a lot of his films have been released during the summer and, you know, would qualify in this category. You know, I think in some ways he's kind of regarded like a bit of a quintessential kind of summer blockbuster director, especially with the Transformer films. But Bad Boys 2 to me is like the absolute like pinnacle of like the like cop action film. Like it is the most aggressive action film probably ever made, in my opinion. And I mean that in a very complimentary sense. There is like an energy in that movie that is just like so aggressive in almost every kind of scene or sequence. And there's like some low key kind of fun moments where they chill and it's funny and stuff like that. But I kind of feel like Michael Bay, when he came back to do that film, it was almost like, I'm going to make the kind of cop action movie to like almost end all action films. And I don't think, and this isn't to take away from any of the incredible action films since, including the Bad Boys sequels, which were amazing. But it, like, it's hard to think of like an action film that is more, it's almost like a war film. Like if you really kind of look at Bad Boys 2, it's really like a war movie, but with these two cops in Miami. And so it kind of like, right, like that, the entire third act of Bad Boys 2 is almost a movie in and of itself. It's like you get the first 2 hours is like this like incredible Michael Bay action movie. And then the third act, it's almost like, guess what, guys? There's a whole more Michael Bay action movie when they do the whole Cuba Havana sequence. It's so amazing. And just everything about it is just like, it's hard to think of something with maybe Mad Max Fury Road being the exception, something kind of like bigger and more just like with that kind of like action energy than Bad Boys 2. There's a reason why in the movie Hot Fuzz, you know, Nick Frost is like, you've never seen Bad Boys 2, you know, and there's like literally the movie is referenced. Like, yeah, it's crazy.
I mean, Bad Boys 2, I knew ever since we have you on the pod that we'll be adding that to the next month's movie list.
Yeah,
Bad Boys 2 is coming to the top.
The topic for this podcast could have been like, we're going to discuss the movie Steel Magnolias or Terms of Endearment, and I would find a way to talk about Bad Boys 2. Don't worry. It's going to find its way in there somewhere. I'll throw another film in there too. I think... And this is, you know, now we're going to start making some declarative statements here.
We love it.
I would say with, you know, Fury Road in competition, Bad Boys 2 in competition, I would say Mission Impossible Fallout.
Okay.
Might be the greatest action film ever made. And, and I think about that movie, that's the one, the basically, I guess I would say the sixth Mission Impossible film. Mm-hmm. I think it was released in 2018. Mm-hmm. That movie is absolutely mind-boggling. Like the fact that it's
very, very good.
Exists, yes. It's so suspenseful. It's so focused in terms of like taking you through things. It kind of like closes out some elements of Ethan Hunt's story. Like they carried through these interesting through lines all the way from Mission Impossible 3 and then Ghost Protocol and then Rogue Nation to Fallout. But that end sequence, the helicopter sequence in Mission Impossible Fallout, is so insane when you think about just the practical nature of what they did, the fact that Tom Cruise is so involved in the stunt work of that, how dangerous it is, everything. And then like, and then that it even actually kind of has this, you know, and then the fight scene with him and Henry Cavill on the cliff, everything about it. It's just, wow.
I mean, I think that movie could have been the perfect ending to the Mission Impossible franchise because of this progression, this evolution, if we'll go by James Cameron standards, of all those movies, of the first, you know, five. No, they're all different. I feel like the first six Mission Impossible movies are very different from each other.
Yes.
But they follow like a nice trajectory, right?
Yes.
And after Fallout, is it Dead Reckoning? Is there one?
Dead Reckoning is the one that came out last year.
I feel like they're just trying to do the Fallout thing, but we've already done the Fallout thing.
Yeah, I think that it's like, you know, when you, I just think that it's like Fallout is such a action masterpiece, mm-hmm, that it's like, it's hard to top something that's that incredible.
You're totally right. Except for the fact that Mission Impossible 2 is the best Mission Impossible movie.
Yeah.
I love it.
Oh, John Woo, baby. Oh, man.
Now that one, I think it's similar to, for me, it's similar to like a, what's it called? John Wick, where it's like we're just gonna do whatever we want. We are just gonna just everything we could possibly. It's not even John Wick. It's just doing John Woo.
It is. And you know what? And that's
exactly what you'd expect John Woo.
Well, that is one of the great things too with the Mission Impossible films, like you're saying, is that for the most part, like they really do have a distinctive style. They, you know, Tom Cruise seems to really kind of like embrace the directors that he's working with and kind of go with, you know, their approach for things. So Brian De Palma, you know, in the doing the first Mission Impossible, it definitely has this kind of like, I say this kind of throwback 70s kind of paranoid thriller vibe, more so than anything else.
I think was there one shot fired in the first movie or something like that, or no shots fired? There's something weird, like there's some, I don't know.
Yeah, it's trivia. It's pretty minimal in terms of that with the bullet train sequence being so awesome. Oh, right. My gosh. Like that was such a, like when I was growing up, that was just like one of the absolute most, just I would rewatch that sequence over and over and over. And then John Woo, you know, really bringing like the slow motion. He's got the doves. He's got the sunglasses, he's got the double guns,
coolness, explosions.
He's got everything. I mean, the whole third act of Mission Impossible 2 is so like it's so John Woo, like kind of unleashing in a cool way, which I would say of all the American John Woo films, like I would probably say Face Off is probably like, you know, the real kind of like epic masterpiece he made. Although Hard Target, oh, you might need to throw Hard Target onto that list.
That could be pretty good.
The third act of Hard Target in this old warehouse where Jean-Claude Van Damme is fighting these guys is like, I rewatched that again on Blu-ray a couple months ago, and I was just like, wow, like it was just so incredibly just John Woo just flexing his muscles, and just it's incredible.
I've been trying to find a way to get more John Woo movies at the Tub.
Yeah,
I mean we've played a couple of them. We did The Killer,
mm-hmm,
and Hard-boiled. We did Face Off. We didn't do Hard Boiled, but I love Hard Boiled.
Yeah,
Hard Boiled is so good.
Yeah.
So I think we need to add one in for sure. But Hard Target, that's a good idea.
Yeah, Hard Target would be, I think, a really...
What's the... I don't think it's John Woo. It might be. What's the one with Dennis Rodman?
Wait, and Jean-Claude Van Damme?
I think so.
Yes.
is it John Woo? No, I don't
know. No. No, John Woo didn't direct. I was just thinking of a Jean-Claude Van Damme, Dennis Rodman movie. I think they did a film together. I'm not sure. John Woo then did, he did a movie called Wind Talkers with Nick Cage, and then he did a movie with Ben Affleck and Aaron Eckhart. oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm having a moment here. It's based on a Philip K. Dick story, but
with Double Team.
Double Team.
That's what it's called.
Yeah. I don't think that was a John Woo.
No, it's
another.
Oh, this is why I don't. This Google search is Tsui Hark. That's who it is.
Yeah.
Yes, but another Hong Kong filmmaker.
Yeah.
So those Hong Kong filmmakers really know how to make an action movie.
Yeah.
It seems.
Can I just mention an action film here that probably doesn't get a lot of love just since...
Is it summer related?
I can't remember if it is. Replacement Killers, which was, I think, produced by John Woo. It's directed by Antoine Fuqua. I think it's his second film. No, that's his first film. His second film was a movie called Bait with Jamie Foxx, which is also pretty cool to watch. It's going to make me want to revisit all these movies.
that's the idea.
Yeah. And then a kind of post Pulp Fiction era, you know, there was kind of this kind of Pulp Fiction esque vibe in the 90s mixed with kind of the John Woo films, a total guilty pleasure movie called The Big Hit, starring Mark Wahlberg and Lou Diamond Phillips. And, that movie is like this really kind of like fun action comedy, but it's got some really cool action sequences. So just throwing these out there.
I like it.
For some tubbies.
Some lesser known flicks for the tubbies to enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of some of these movies, it's a matter of how to watch it.
Yeah.
You know, releases and stuff. I forgot to mention True Lies did just get a new 4K release.
Yeah, they took forever on some of those
Films. And The Abyss didn't even have a Blu-ray. They skipped Blu-ray. They went DVD.
I know these have been a bit of points of controversy for us physical media people.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I know, and then Aliens too. I guess James Cameron's just like, we're going to release them all. But I know Aliens, for problems with transfers, Aliens, I think, has gotten a lukewarm reception with some weird AI, you know.
Well, there is I don't know what they're doing in terms of upscaling certain things if they are relying on AI, which there are some programs that actually do a pretty good job with that, like you can use it on, we'll say, some of your own projects, but I don't know if they're actually putting studio films through it. That'd be a interesting thing to know.
Can we get Hard Target on a good release? Is there a Blu-ray?
There is a Blu-ray, and it's absolutely fantastic.
Really?
In fact, when you watch,
like Shout Factory,
watch Hard Target, watch this scene. There's a scene in the middle-ish of the movie where Jean-Claude Van Damme is on a motorcycle. I don't want to ruin it, but this movie is 30 years old. And some bad guys are in this like van coming at him, shooting at him with machine guns. He's on a motorcycle headed towards them, showdown style. And his motorcycle is leaking gas as he's going. And as he's approaching, he stands up onto the seat of the motorcycle, like surfing the motorcycle, basically, as it's headed directly at the van. He has a head-on collision with the van, and then in super slow motion rolls, like does this incredible like somersault over the roof of the van and lands on the other side, pulls his gun, ping, 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 boom, blows the motorcycle up under the van and takes out the bad guys. It is the stuff dreams are made of. I don't know how else to put it.
I love it.
Gonna make you cry. It is so amazing. So
that's the most John Woo thing I've ever heard.
You know, here's the thing. I'll be honest. I miss that kind of action. I know that some people look at that as you know, we've kind of gotten into very, like, we want things to be very grounded and very realistic and everything like that. And I absolutely love those approaches to films and action films. And when it's done right, like, it's really, really cool to see more fantastical ideas done in a way that's just, like, so grounded and rooted.
Right.
Because you're like, wow, like, I could actually see this. Like, this could be a real thing. Like, that was the genius in a lot of ways of Christopher Nolan's approach to Batman, was that he was like, you've seen kind of the more over-the-top hyperbolic version of Batman. Let's bring him into kind of this realistic. And so it just feels as though now when you walk through a city in downtown at night, like, you could be like, oh, Batman is up on that roof. But I love also the kind of, you know, really, like, you know, am just relishing in what action movies are, which is this kind of, like, very over the top, you know, right, vibe
not,
and feel.
Not realistic. We're not just realistic. Fun.
and kind of finding, and I think that, like, action films, you get, like, you know, you can get away with one kind of, like, especially if, even if you try to do, like, the ground thing, you can get away with one, like, really incredible over the top action sequence.
Right, right.
What I'm thinking of when I'm saying that is, like, Fast Five.
Gotcha.
And you knew that this was headed towards the Fast and Furious.
I was trying to veer you away from it. I was trying.
I was going to find a way to get it over to the Fast and Furious. Fast Five is, like, probably where that balance, you know, where everything kind of came together. Although Fast Six is, like, it's so good.
I do think, yeah, Fast and Furious would be that, you know, over the top. I keep thinking of the word cheesy. It's not necessarily cheesy, but
how dare,
like,
you?
There's there's an element to where it's like, yeah, this is not real life, but I still love it. And
right.
I think that is like a modern day, you know, John Woo type action movie where it's just over the top, and I love it.
Yes. I mean, in the end, like, it's all about really character first, mm-hmm. and then, you know, story second, but very close to.
All John Woo movies are about friendship, right?
They're all about friendship. Friends,
right? Is that?
I would.
most of them, maybe.
You know, yeah, I guess you could kind of say, like, there's a certain element of that, you know. Friendship, just hanging
other
out.
Other things. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, that's the thing. It's like, if your characters and everything feel, you know, it's not, they don't have to be, you know, it's not likable, but they feel interesting,
right,
to an audience. And they can be, and interesting means there's elements you love about them, and there's also weaknesses within the character, and the story or the action sequences in some ways are helping to explore those weaknesses and let the character overcome those moments of challenge in the action sequence. That's the absolute, you know, most cathartic thing that can happen in an action film. So,
I mean, it is the Fast and Furious movies are very similar to the Mission Impossible movies in that there is an evolution, back James Cameron evolution, but there is a definite raising of the stakes in each movie. And I don't know, maybe Fast and Furious doesn't change genres.
I think it goes from a crime thriller with action elements in the beginning to and I would say that holds actually probably all the way to through the fourth, to Fast and Furious. I'd say Fast Five was where they really, and I remember watching that as well and going, like, oh wow, this is like a heist film. Like, they're really, like, leaning harder into, you know, we got to put the team together type stuff. And so then it's like this kind of international crew, and then from that
espionage.
And so now, like, where the films are like absolute basically Mission Impossible. The Fast and Furious films are basically Mission Impossible and superhero films, but the superpowers are cars in the Fast and Furious world, because I don't think Universal, if I'm not mistaken, they don't really have, like, a superhero bench the way, like, Disney or Warner Brothers do necessarily. But what is so cool is that like something like The Fast and Furious actually kind of is a superhero story. But like I said, the powers are cars. So when you're getting like a spy thing, you know, you're getting a spy film and a superhero story. But I like to call the Fast and Furious franchise the LA mythology. But I didn't come here to necessarily dominate this with Fast and Furious.
Well, I will say a movie I was thinking about, I mean, we mentioned it briefly with John Wick, but John Wick 4, I think, might be the best of the John Wick movies, but definitely is an example of the pure action movie.
Yes.
And it feels like a David Lean movie where it's just this brawling epic where this guy is, you know, going.
Yes, I would say a David Lean and definitely a Sergio Leone movie. Totally. Like it's definitely the good, the bad, and the ugly of the John Wick films.
Right.
Here's another thing.
And we need more of those types of movies. I know John Wick is, you know,
popular. I'm going to even, now that I think about this, this is the perfect platform to discuss something that needs to be discussed. And that's the Western. Okay. The Western is often regarded as like, oh, Westerns, they're a big genre in the 60s. And then they died out or whatever. But what's so amazing about the Western, and of course I love the more, we'll say, traditional Western, mm-hmm. like, you know, the Western, like, don't get me on Tombstone, okay? Because if we go on Tombstone, we're not getting off that movie. Like, that is, like, just so awesome. But what's interesting is that the Western had evolved into something else. And when you look at like a lot of modern day action films, they're basically the Western. You know, if you look at The Fast and Furious or John Wick, those are Westerns. I mean, John Wick 4 ends in a showdown. And The Fast and Furious is literally like, especially if you look at the first film, it's the cowboys trying to steal from the train. It's, you know, that's kind of headed to the cliff type stuff. It's the gunslingers with, you know, the old gunslinger versus the new gunslinger kind of for dominance over things. Like the Western genre is still alive today, boys and girls. It's just moved into a different, it's just evolved and actually kind of, you know, permeated into so many different other genres. So thank goodness for that.
100%. And I mean, would you see, it's funny because I would consider, you know, the John Wicks, the Fast and Furious as, I mean, these, you know, modern Westerns, like you're saying, as summer movies. But I don't know if I would particularly say that, you know, an old Western, even a European Western, would be a summer movie. I could be wrong. What do you think?
You know, what's funny is that I've thought about this a lot. I'm like, why not? Like, I know, look.
I'm with you, why not?
Yeah.
But why not?
Making movies is very expensive. And so, you know, you'd have to really try and sell, you know, a studio or producers on, you know, that you're going to do basically a big action film Western. And you know, like we'll say something to the scale or vibe or feel of like a Fast and Furious or a Mission Impossible movie set in what I guess we'll say the Old West. And I think that there have been movies that have kind of leaned into that. And the problem a little bit is that like you'd have to really like lock into taking it kind of serious in some ways. Like what makes the Fast and Furious movies successful and work is that they're not trying to be tongue in cheek, even though, yes, they have these like sequences that would never happen in real life or anything like that. They're never sitting there like embarrassed by, you know, the fact that they did something in an action sequence that's so crazy and that they're kind of like winking to the audience like, wasn't that crazy? there's nothing like that. It's very earnest. And that's what I think is actually one of the keys to success with, you know, the action genre. Although I certainly love kind of like a fun tongue-in-cheek thing, like
those are also good.
Yes, like and I'm thinking of something like Hot Fuzz, you know, that kind of is self-referential and kind of meta in its approach, but also actually, you know, uses that as a way to get more earnestly into the characters.
I mean, there's some connection there with like comedy films and comedy performances where you look at like Leonardo DiCaprio and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Like, he is so funny in that movie, but it's funny because he doesn't know he's funny. He's playing it completely seriously.
Oh yeah.
So there's a way, there's like a weird way of doing it where it's like, you know,
I could watch that scene.
If you're playing it true and serious, then you actually, it ends up, you know.
Then it actually, it works. You commit, you're committing to what you're doing. And that takes, we'll say, kind of guts to do it. And so, you know, if you're going to do, let's say, like an action film or like something that would be a blockbuster in and set it in the Old West, you have to like own that. And right. You have to go into it as like, we're doing this. And it's not going to be like, you know, too, I guess I want to say the word goofy or anything like that. Like,
silly.
Yeah, like you're finding a way to do The Dark Knight or whatever in the Old West and do like that type of, bring that, but it'd be very expensive.
I got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Is a disaster movie an action movie?
It's definitely a subgenre within the action.
Okay, good. Maybe.
Yeah.
maybe it's a stretch.
Because I would say that like the films of Roland Emmerich, who's probably like the disaster, the modern disaster right. movie king, would qualify as action films, you mm-hmm. know. 2012, The Day After Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of some of the other kind of disaster films he's...
Well, we talked about this a couple of days ago, but a movie I do really want to watch at the tub is Dante's Peak.
Oh, yeah, Dante's Peak, yeah, of course.
Dante's Peak.
Directed by Roger Donaldson, mm-hmm. I believe, and Pierce Brosnan, yeah.
I think it fits in the summer film
I think
umbrella.
It does. And I think that it kind of is like in some ways also, you know, when they've done the double kind of movie where, you know, two films that seem very similar come out at the same time.
Volcano.
You know, Volcano and Dante's Peak. You know, Volcano probably with Tommy Lee Jones is probably, I think, leaning a little more into the summer movie kind of crowd pleasing-ish movie. It has one.
Right.
It has a scene in that movie.
Volcano or Dante's
Volcano.
Peak?
That is so, so horrifying.
That when he melts into
yes.
The, no way you're thinking about
that. Oh, that's the one I'm thinking of.
Bring that up. Because what's that actor's name? I forget his name. But yeah, he's on the back of the subway.
And he's like carrying and he like throws somebody yes. and he's like going into the lava. I remember watching that and we were like, what a horrific yes. way to die.
That's exactly what I was thinking of. I was going to mention that. I'm so glad you mentioned that.
Is that movie PG-13 or is it rated R?
I think it is PG-13 because I distinctly remember being like 11 years old and having the Volcano DVD and watching that and being horrified, but I love it.
Right. Totally. Such a horrific. They're like, let's put the most, I would say that like,
I can't believe you were thinking.
Oh, you know, well, of course we're thinking of the same scene. That's like the scene you think of in that movie is you're like, remember when the guy jumps into lava and like melts like the Wicked Witch in,
and no one can do anything.
And no one can do anything, and he's just like the most horrific. And I just remember thinking, like, what? You know, that's this is the joy of movies, though. Like, you get those moments that just change your life forever, and you didn't even see it coming. Let me know when we're watching that so I can
we'll do it a double feature with Dante's Peak.
Yeah, Dante's Peak though is that kind of more, I think, probably the more grounded
right
Volcano film right. in terms of kind of like, whereas Volcano is much more of the like, you know, LA, like I mean you're just thinking of the setting alone, like a volcano in Los Angeles, you know? And then they use, spoiler alert, guys, the movie's 30 years old. They use the LA River as a way of, you know, getting the lava out of the city. it's like, you know, it's definitely like a movie, you know what I mean? Whereas Dante's Peak, it feels like, they kind of like, it was probably inspired by like Mount St. Helens when that you know, happened in that disaster, and they're like, you know.
You know, I think my favorite, one of my favorite disaster movies, and we played it at the Tub. I want to say it was 2 summers ago. It could have been last summer. I forget. But is The Towering Inferno. And that movie is so good, and definitely would consider an action movie, even though I don't think a single bullet is shot.
Oh, yeah.
But that's just such an intense movie. I remember before we watched At the Tub, I was like looking at the runtime, and I'm like, this movie's like 3 hours long. Like, how could it possibly hold that long? And then the whole time you're watching it, and you're like,
yes. You know, well, I mean, there was like, yeah. I mean, there was, they really, I don't know, they really knew how to captivate people. You know, a lot of times people like,
I mean, having Paul Newman and Bronson in your movie,
oh, it's gonna help. Helps. But I think, like, to, you know, to younger tubbies and to younger filmmakers and everything, I think that there's definitely like a lot of power in going back and watching some of the older films and really looking at the kind of storytelling, because they didn't necessarily have the same toys that everybody does today, that, you know, and so to really wow the audience, they, you know, it's not to say that there wasn't spectacle back then, because there was, but it was, you know, really kind of like knowing that you got to make sure your characters are, you know, really, you know, compelling and interesting, and you want to kind of go on this adventure with them and stuff like that. So
totally, 100%. Last thing I do want to talk about before we end is not necessarily action movies. I'm trying to think of if any of these are action movies. There probably is, but the nostalgia movie.
Oh yeah.
There's something about the American Graffiti, the Stand By Me, Dazed and Confused. I'm just rattling them off here because I was writing them down earlier, but I think those movies are perfect in the summer, and I have no idea why.
Oh yeah, no, that's an excellent point. I think that those definitely, the nostalgia movie. Yeah, that's definitely something that, like,
I mean, I guess it's because we think back at you know, our childhood or whatever. I mean,
I'd say something, you know, probably a little bit more lighthearted, but in that era too, in some ways, is like The Sandlot.
Right, totally. Yeah, exactly.
Reminds that fits right in. You of playing in the neighborhood with your friends, and
exactly
the dog that was scary
in the summer.
In the summer,
right?
Yes, and you know, there's a certain element too of, like, you know, you sometimes have friends in your life that come and go, and where you guys are next to each other or hanging out for maybe during that summer, and then all of a sudden school starts and things completely shift all of a sudden one day. And those movies you kind of mentioned in some way, I think, have a little bit of that feel or that element where they, like, it's like capturing a moment in time, and that's very powerful, and you know, movies really kind of, like,
oh yeah. I mean, were you a road trip child?
In the sense that
did you go on a lot of road trips?
Yeah. We mostly traveled through. I mean, you know, most of my childhood was spent traveling in the back of a minivan, and so we definitely drove.
Because I think that's the nostalgia movie, I think, is adjacent to the road trip movie for that reason. I mean, I guess there are a lot of road trip movies that aren't really nostalgic in any way, but I think the road trip movie also is a great summer movie.
Yeah.
For me, for, you know, for the Tubbies. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, National Lampoons, stuff like that, you'd definitely kind of throw in there.
I want to watch Little Miss Sunshine.
Oh, yeah.
At the Tub. Not again at the Tub. We haven't done it at the Tub. I want to watch it at the Tub for this exact reason we're talking about. But, yeah, I mean, I think definitely the nostalgia road trip thing is another big, you know, theme or genre for me in the discussion of summer movies, and they play really good at the Tub.
Yeah,
and not to say action movies don't, but action movies, there's something about seeing an action movie in IMAX.
Oh,
and well, let me just wait. Hold on, I forgot to mention this. We haven't done a podcast in a while, so The Tub has a brand new projector. We upgraded a lot. five times, we'll say. But we have a nice new 4K HDR, whatever, new projector that looks great. And the sound system, it sounds great. So I think action movies will play a lot better than I was about to say. But action movies at the Tub are great. But I think there's also an element of an intimate movie, a smaller movie, that works really well. And I like to tap into that usually with the programming.
Yeah, I think that, everything is going to be, more impactful on a bigger screen. That's just the way it is. And especially with what the Tub has to offer, which is top notch. So
the next best thing to IMAX is what I've heard people saying in the lobby.
They call it Tub Max.
The Tub Max.
So you're going to get that. An incredible experience at the Tub. So
Tub Max might be the name of next month's month. We should call it Tub Max. We might call it Tub Max. Actually, I think we just decided that that's what it's going to be called.
You heard it here first, people.
All right. Well, I think we covered a lot of things. Mostly James Cameron.
I'm just kidding. James Cameron, Michael Bay. John Wick, John Woo, all the great, there's so many, and there's honestly so many we're leaving out. So many great action films, so many great action directors, and a lot of subgenres of action as well. So,
I want anyone who's listening to this before the Tub schedule comes out, if you don't hear a movie that you feel is definitely a summer movie and we definitely need to watch at the Tub, feel free to message me on Instagram, or actually we have a website now. Did I mention that? No, I didn't. We have the Tub Theater, tubtheater.com. Maybe it's thetubtheater.com. Ooh. But we have a website now. We have a YouTube page now. Anyway, you can contact us, give us a message and tell us your picks for summer movies. Cause, I haven't decided yet. And this podcast, this episode is very good for finding those ideas and finding that schedule. Cause,
speed fun. And speed to speed. Cruise control.
Yep. We'll start with Cruise Control and
work backwards.
You actually go backwards. It's a lot more impactful that way. But thanks for coming. Thanks for being on the Tubcast.
Thank you. Yeah, this is fun.
I'm hoping to do a lot more of these. So we'll keep rolling and pumping Tubcasts out. And thank you. I don't know how to end it. What's this button?
Oh. Hey-o!